Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words. In partnership with The Honor Project, we've brought this podcast back at a time when our nation needs these stories more than ever. Warriors in Their Own Words is our attempt to present an unvarnished, unsanitized truth of what we have asked of those who defend this nation. Thank you for listening, and by doing so, honoring those who have served. Today, we'll hear from Fred Wellman, who served in the Army for 22 years as an aviator and public affairs officer. Fred was a Black Hawk helicopter pilot and completed four tours during Operations Desert Storm and Iraqi Freedom. He was also a spokesman for General David Petraeus and General Martin Dempsey in Iraq.
My name is Fred Wellman. I'm a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel. I spent 22 years in service. I started off as an Army aviator, flying OH-58 Scouts, later UH-60 Blackhawks, and then transitioned late in my career to be a public affairs officer at the highest levels. I served in Desert Storm and three Iraq tours. My family has a long military tradition. We literally came over here in 1640 from England. The first Wellman to serve in the uniform on the North American continent served the French and Indian War. He was impressed that the British troops marched through his town and took him along. We had a Minuteman answer the Lexington alarm and participate all the way through the Battle of Trenton and beyond. My father was a Marine at the tail end of World War II. So we really, there was a long military tradition in my family, like so many that serve. There's a military tradition in their family. As I was looking at my options, as I loved flying. I'd love the idea of being a pilot someday. I was looking at my options. It was the early 80s as I approached college. I dabbled in Marine Corps ROTC and actually got rejected, which is a really unique story in and of itself. But in the end, West Point, the idea of going to West Point really appealed to me. The idea of having the opportunity to go to the United States Military Academy as a kid from Missouri and all that went with that was a passion. And it's funny, I got there and I used to joke that I graduated from West Point because I ran out of time to quit. and in the end, I graduated. I got commissioned as an aviator, and suddenly I find myself flying helicopters in Korea or Desert Storm or Hawaii. And it's there's great passion for service in our family. I started off as a scout pilot. I started flying OH-58s in Korea, and I flew OH-58 Scouts in Desert Storm, flew them and commanded them in Hawaii. I ended up going into the Black Hawk right before Iraq 1 OAF. And the aircraft is such a beautiful aircraft. It's powerful. It's agile. For me, coming out of the tiny little scout helicopter, which was great, but didn't have enough power to really do fun stuff, flying a Black Hawk with all that power. And our mission was such a cool one in my unit in Iraq. We kind of had all the weird stuff. I had a Pathfinder platoon of infantrymen, and we had the mission actually that if any of our aircraft went down during the invasion of Iraq, I would be the one to go in and rescue them. Really just a cool, fun mission and a great experience. I miss terribly. Actually got to fly recently here in St. Louis. I may go back to flying helicopters again yet. The thing about being a pilot is you realize that there's great responsibility with it. It's actually why I'm so hard on fellow pilots even to this day, is the idea that when you place your hands on those controls and you lift gently off the ground, that all the lives and souls on that aircraft are your responsibility. Yeah, even I learned this as a young scout pilot. I had a left seater. In those days, we actually had enlisted air observers in Desert Storm. And Chris Anderson, who I'm still friends with to this day, was my enlisted air observer. And I taught him how to fly as much as the aircraft as I could. I taught him how to land the aircraft. If I took a bullet, his life was in my hands. And my life was in his hands in many ways. And that integration of understanding that a moment's bad decision could lead to the loss of both of our lives. And then even more so when you get in a Black Hawk, you know, in Iraq, you've got seats out. So you've managed to pack 18 people in the back, stacked, you know, shoulder to shoulder. And that awesome response that goes with understanding that you have the power to both save lives and take lives. I think too often we forget that part of service. We forget that part of, and even as a civilian, if you've got those kind of responsibilities, but there is a great response that goes with service to your country and service to your fellow service members. So I never forgot that. Again, I'm passionate to this day of understanding that you have a great responsibility to those who are entrusted with their lives or entrusted to you. Well, when we were doing the, you know, doing the invasion of Iraq, we took seats out. That the advantage of that is I can squeeze an entire squad or half a platoon in the back of a Black Hawk. Again, the one thing about the Black Hawk, if you're just carrying people, that's nothing. I know it sounds like a lot of people, but that's a light load for a Black Hawk with seats out, you know, 12 people. Again, just people is nothing to a Black Hawk. This is an aircraft that can lift, you know, huge loads, but it's a blast. It's a blast with the doors open and you're strapped in. You got your feet dangling on the side of the doors. I flew missions when we first flew into Iraq, you know, dropping off food. We got the notice that we'd taken Najaf on the march to Baghdad. We were trying to negotiate with the Mr. Sistani, who's had his mosque there. He asked for food. So we were tasked to grab as much MREs and we could pack onto aircraft and fly straight into the airfield that had just been taken under fire and just literally kick as many. You know, in those moments when you see that, you see, you know, you just, the infantry wouldn't get off the ground to come help us unload the aircraft. We had to like just kick all the stuff out ourselves right on the runway and take off again. You know, like I said, you look back and you see these guys stacked up, falling asleep on each other. The thing about war, the thing about especially war, is these remarkable moments of clarity where you're in the middle of a mission or you're in the middle of a moment and you know with clarity that you're living history, that you recognize that as you are doing what is a relatively mundane task, perhaps, or something you've trained for your whole life, that you are going to be a side note in a historic moment. And I've been very blessed that I've had that feeling. I knew as I lifted off flying into Iraq, that especially that second time, that this was a historic moment that would be talked about for ages. I knew as I landed for the first time at Saddam Hussein Airport in Baghdad that this was a moment, carrying delegates to their first conference in democracy, sitting in the room when Donald Rumsfeld came to visit Iraq to talk about the next stage of the war in 2006. You sit there and kind of go, geez, man, I'm the fly in the wall that people talk about. And I think that's one of the most remarkable things about serving a country in these moments in our time is that ability to be part of what will end up being the history of your nation is really an awesome part of what we do. I joke all the time that I liked invading Iraq. I did it twice. I sounds terrible when you say it out loud, but you know. So I of course did Desert Storm. You know, Desert Storm. I was a scout pilot for Apaches. You know, we have been participating in reconnaissance missions. We have been surveilling the border. You know, I actually went in a daytime once the invasion started, the ground invasion, and for Desert Storm especially. I experienced the same, a similar in Iraq Freedom is. You go in and as far as the eye can see is vehicles and it's a Mad Max. You can envision Mad Max, but on steroids. Like I remember seeing seven columns of vehicles going into Iraq from Saudi Arabia across the desert, dust everywhere. You know, you're flying along just over their heads, leading your troops, leading your flight. And that moment you go, wow, Jesus, you know, there was especially a Desert Storm. There was moments where you're like, no movie could compare to what I'm seeing here. You know, the vastness of what we do when the might of the American military kicks in, it's a vast enterprise of power. It's hard to imagine it. I said, I did have a hard time doing a movie without CGI, trying to depict the thousands of vehicles rushing headlong northbound into Iraq to cut off our enemies and outmaneuver them as fast as possible. I remember, especially in Desert Shield, flying scouts in the dark. The technology then wasn't as advanced as it was in 2003. And so it was very dangerous. We had one mission where we were pushing the limits of our technology and the ability. There was a night mission where they called us out because there had been a reports of Iraqis probing the border during the air war. I took off in the middle of the night with a scout weapons team, a OH-58 scout and two Apaches. And we got out there. It was pitch dark. I mean, all I saw was black. And luckily, the Apaches have infrared. So at that point, you say, all right, lead us home, the Apaches. And it was funniest thing happened. The division commander wanted me to come brief them. And I'm like, okay, how am I? You know, where? I mean, this vast sea of tents lined up along the border. And luckily, my battalion commander had to come outside with a flashlight and, like, wave me down to where I should land. You knew you were really riding the edge of your technology, your ability. When I came home from that mission, it was extremely challenging to land, and the dust. We had zero visibility, plus we had the dust, which led to the decision a very difficult decision just a day later when we had another night mission into Iraq. And my crews essentially came to me and said, look, you know, we need to send only the most senior crews in this mission to Iraq. You need to sit this one out. Essentially, they did a intervention, if you will. And so consulting with my commander, decided just to send my instructor pilot, my more senior pilot, Hal Reichel, into Iraq. And sure enough, they go into Iraq and found weather, pouched into weather, and never returned. Years we could tell, Hal flew into the ground at about 90 knots. And so there's this realization as a leader, one of the unique things about being a leader in the military, and especially in combat, is the responsibility of knowing that someone could lose their lives based on the decisions you make and the guidance you give. And I experienced that. I unfortunately experienced that loss, knowing that a mission I was supposed to be on led to the deaths of two very good men at a very young age. The original tactics for attack helicopter battalions and CAV was actually a legacy of Vietnam with OH-58 Charlie Kiowas and AH-1 Cobras. And then we continued that when the AH-64 was fielded. So the way we organized for missions was it depended on the mission. So for a mission where we're sort of doing reconnaissance, we're trying to make contact, we're actually not sure where the enemy is, we're trying to develop the situation, we would break us into what they call scout weapons teams. So my platoon, I had four OH-58s, and then we had six Apaches in a standard AH-64 company. In my unit, it was first the 24th Aviation, 24th ID. And so we would go in as a scout weapons team with the Apaches. So I was the light team. So I had two Apaches, and my colleague would have four Apaches and two scouts. In that team, the Apache is the most valuable piece of equipment, right? And so the scout would go ahead. So typically, if we're doing a scout weapons formation, the scout would be slightly ahead of the Apaches, if not a mile or more, kind of feeling out the ground, looking for targets. This manifests itself when during the last part of Desert Storm, as we cross Route 1, we had reports of multiple movements of heavy divisions of Iraqis on the highway. We were sent in. All we had was the information there was tanks. So I took my scouts out ahead of time, and we developed, you know, looking for targets. So we went out actually without the Apaches. And then once we found a good spot to put the Apaches to that could have a line of sight on the highway, then we brought the Apaches in and then broke into teams. So it was dependent on the tactical situation. But it was funny because that day we broke into the light team. I had one of my Apaches, when he went to go spin up his rockets, actually fired a pair of rockets at me and damn near took me out accidentally, which would have been a bummer, a hell of a way to get shot down by your own Apache, but which happened a lot because the just a spark could set those rockets off. But yeah, you just take these systems and you go develop. That's what we did. We would go up. I mean, that day I remember vividly, you know, flying my scout up to the highway, and it turned out the Iraqis were hiding underneath the bridges. And so I would come up and they'd shoot at us from underneath the bridge. I'd break right, break left, and then call the Apaches, and the Apaches would come in and destroy the target. But it was a great system. Years later, they would kind of just go to pure Apache companies and they'd do their own scouting essentially. But in those early days, it was really great. The scouts were great. Our job was navigating. Our job was finding targets, sort of being the bait a little bit. So, and we were unarmed. That was the really interesting part, is your unarmed aircraft. So high adventure, you could say. We were constantly training at Fort Stewart to seamlessly transition from whatever the situation was. So if it was the scouts going ahead to identify a battle position for the Apaches and then bringing them in to line up, you know, six astride shooting at things, to seamlessly transition to how to break into teams to find targets. We had done this over and over, almost to the point of being, it was boring. We could do it so seamlessly that it was just part of our DNA. Very little, we never had to talk about where you at. Where'd you go? It was always, we all knew each other so instinctively, having trained so hard at Fort Stewart, that by the time we got into combat, it was really just focusing on the tactical situation at hand. Where was the target? Who do we develop? And my whole career was dictated by what I learned as a young lieutenant in the 24th ID, that unit, that, you know, we do the training over and over and over until it becomes a muscle movement. And that way you're ready for almost anything. So whenever the tactical situation changes with combat, when the enemy gets a vote, you're ready, because the actual functioning of the organization is a muscle movement. The actual adapting to the targeting is where you put your brain into things. So I think the attacks were solid for Desert Storm, especially in the end. We used them throughout in the very, almost every single of the tactics we had practiced, we used at the tactical level during Desert Storm, especially in just that short time. it's a tough fraternity to join when you lose soldiers. For us, you know, we flew the night mission. They flew the night mission, I should say, came back, and Hal and Mike didn't return. So we spent the night trying to find them. And then in the morning, we actually sent an entire company of Apaches and Blackhawks into Iraq to sort of fly the routes. And then they found the aircraft crashed several hundred or a dozen kilometers into Iraq. The war doesn't stop. The need for our mission doesn't change. So it's tough. I remember when we found out, me and Doug Gurman, the commander, kind of took ourselves aside. I remember I was sitting in a bunker with Doug, sort of just crying it out, you know, a grown adult man just sort of crying it out together quietly as commanders, and then kind of getting our stuff together to go back to the team and give them the short break. I mean, we had a memorial service the very day, and during the memorial service, we actually got a haul to go take off for a potential, you know, Iraqi incursion. I actually left the memorial service running to my aircraft to launch. And that defines it, right? That the challenge you have is that with loss, you still have to go on with the mission. And I think in many ways, though, for that time, we never understood. I mean, my God, I was home 6 weeks later, and we really talk about it. You know, I mean, in the 90s, we just sort of moved on, if you will, that we didn't know survivor's guilt was a thing, which I only found out when I was in my 50s that that I had survivor's guilt, which was just like PTSD. And so it is a very difficult thing to manage. But again, you do fall back on your training. You fall back on the years that went into preparing you for that moment and the leadership that kicks in to say, look, this is bad. We've lost guys. We still have a mission to continue. How do we do it? I mean, I had to reorganize my unit because I'd lost essentially a third of my combat power with that loss. I wasn't getting any replacements. So we went into Iraq without replacements. So you just have to kind of just dust yourself off and fly the mission, because the mission doesn't stop just because you lose folks, unfortunately. For me, it was a very formative thing. I mean, I was 25 years old. And so managing that stress and carrying it is sort of the burden of command. That's what people talk about, the burden of command. You will have to make those decisions that could lead to men dying, and you're going to have to live with that. It's not for everybody.
Hello, this is Gary Chachot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.
Hello, my name is Peter Zablocki, and I'm a historian, author, and college professor. I'm thrilled to invite you to check out Evergreen Network's History Shorts podcast. Every Tuesday and Thursday, join me on a journey through time, exploring the little-known and hidden gems of history. In each bite-sized episode, I'll dive into my original research to bring you intriguing historical curiosities you've probably never heard of, uncovering the fascinating stories that have shaped our world, from forgotten figures to overlooked events. And the best part? I've condensed all this historical goodness into manageable chunks, perfect for your on-the-go lifestyle. Whether you're commuting to work or squeezing in a quick break, History Shorts fits into the little time you probably think you don't have. Subscribe now and never miss an episode of the History Shorts podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts.
So I go to Iraq in another great unit. It's funny though, I was the operations officer for a Black Hawk battalion. I was the S3. My battalion commander was a great guy, just damn nice guy. I figured out early on though, we couldn't have two nice guys, right? The XO was a pretty nice guy too. So I joke often that when we invaded Iraq the second time, I was really an asshole. And what I mean by really an asshole was like, look, I'm taking everybody home this time. You know, I learned my lesson that you have to be more direct. You have to be very direct in making sure that the procedures are followed that safety is protocols, that we're doing the things we need to do to be ready. So I was relentless in our training preparation for the second invasion. I was that asshole running around saying, put your damn helmet on or dig your damn hole, you know, because the last thing on earth I wanted to do is try to have to explain to a widow, as I did to another widow previously, two widows, that, you know, just the idea that we took a rocket attack and I had guys sitting on their lazy asses instead of digging holes, was infuriating to me. So I was a relentless asshole and I'm proud of it. And you know what? Every single one of my men and women came home from that trip. So I think it shaped everything for me. I mean, there's a feeling goes into it. And then I went back. I mean, I remember going back for my fourth tour or my third Iraq tour and thinking, you know, man, at some point my luck's going to run out. You know, I mean, the night before I arrived in my unit, the trailer next to mine got taken out by a rocket. I was like, whoa, you're really kind of gambling at some point. But it does. I think it framed for me my whole career, my approach to training, my approach to prepping men and women for combat was relentless. For many years, I didn't associate much with any of my former soldiers from that unit because I thought they don't want to hang out with me because I was such an asshole. And I had the nicest note from someone that was actually on a plane, and they found out they were sitting next to somebody who was one of my soldiers from Iraq. And they said, oh, man, you know, Wellman got us ready. You know, Wellman kept us alive. He literally told the guy, he goes, Wellman kept us alive through that tour. I was like, well, that's a hell of a compliment. And that doesn't mean we didn't do tough things. It doesn't mean we didn't fly very dangerous missions. But I do believe you train and you prepare and you're relentless in the discipline that goes into military preparation and military service, you can lower the odds of losing troops to the random things. Because, you know, most deaths in combat aren't directly related to the enemy. Even Hal and Mike, they crashed because of weather. It wasn't enemy action. And so I, as a leader, have been obsessed since, and while I was in the military, with taking out and reducing the risk of those factors causing me to lose men or women in combat. I think a lot of people thought that OIF would be much like Desert Storm, where we would take down the country and then leave. I remember having this conversation with my peers. One ended up being a 3-star general when he was the Brigade 3, but then... and saying, look, I don't think you get it. There's no government. There's nobody to hand it off to. We're it. You know, we kind of Pottery Barn, right? We broke it. We got to fix it. And so I remember early on when I arrived at Key West Air Base in northern Iraq, we were one of the first people there. I had no spare people. I had a pilot with a pistol as my gate guard, if you will. And an older gentleman approaches the note in English and a kid. He had a kid with him. And the note essentially said that they used to get their water from the base and that there was bullets laying in their village from the base. I would only find out later that my infantry counterparts had set up a range thinking there was nothing on the other side of the hill, and there was. So unfortunately, their bullets kept on going and landed in the village. And that led to an incredible adventure of serving as sort of the civil affairs guy for that large swath around Key West. So my very first experience working with Iraqi part was literally local Iraqis who had been devastated by the loss of their government and were struggling to make ends meet. And we became their government anyway. So we ended up building schools and a clinic and delivering water and building roads. So that morphed into, for follow-on tours, where I served as an advisor to the Ministry of Defense and the Joint Staff, the Iraqi military, advising them on public affairs and helping them build their offices and build their capabilities. So I really, I spent the next three tours working closely with our Iraqi partners and helping their country get better or worse, if you will. I mean, even our Iraqi counterparts who as civilians who made the brave decision to even work with us, Dr. Muhammad, that man I mentioned, the man who sent one of his older villagers to meet us, Dr. Muhammad ended up being the leader of my efforts to interact with my Iraqi counterparts. Dr. Muhammad would be murdered in the clinic I built him in 2012. He made a brave, very brave decision to better his people at great risk to himself. Again, he was blown up in 2006, lost two of his legs, and then he was murdered 6 years later. Sheikh Rod, who was the sheikh of another village, ended up joining when Mosul sort of fell in 2004. He took his villagers and basically created a police force in his village, which ended up being an early Iraqi battalion, ended up being a battalion commander in the Iraqi army before being pushed out because they wanted to have a more formal army. And then he was murdered. Bassam, my first interpreter, was murdered for being an interpreter. you know, again, I could go on and on. Colonels I work with, the Iraqi Minister of Defense, were assassinated. You know, these men and women, but mostly men, were stepping up for their country. And they did right. It didn't always go well. It was a very dangerous place. It still is, which is why I'm so passionate about helping our interpreters and our allies get safety when the time comes. When I asked Dr. Muhammad, I remember sitting in the village day one day saying, I don't understand it. Why are these people able to place bombs in broad daylight on the side of the highway? I know people are seeing them. Why are they reporting to the authorities? Why aren't they doing the right thing? And Muhammad said, you must understand. He says, for 30 years in Iraq, you didn't see things. You know, you did not see the men in the black car pull up and take the neighbors away in the middle of the night. You didn't see it. And so when you see a country that's been under authoritarian rule try to become something else overnight, and the foolishness of our hubris to believe that we could convert that in a quick manner, that we could convert it in just months. Hey, we'll have an election. Everything's better now. Is such a hubristic approach. People forget the democratic traditions that existed in the colonies long before we had America. Okay, that wasn't the case in Iraq. And so we were working to solve that. And something I say often to this day is, at some point we decided that every solution to everything was a hammer, that the U.S. military was the solution, that we're going to use soldiers like me to build schools. We're going to use soldiers like me to make sure girls got to school. That's great. But the problem with that is when everything, the only tool you've got in the toolbox is a hammer, well, everything's a nail. Everything needs to be hammered. And so I knew very early on that there was going to be limits to what we could accomplish if we didn't approach it with an understanding of the Iraqi people and what they wanted, their needs. And this goes to our politicians. I had someone who is a very famous politician today come over and tell us that we should break Iraq into three parts. There should be a Kurdish and a Shia and a Sunni. Just break it up. I'm like, okay, that sounds awesome, but that's not what they want. You know. And so it was just, that was 2006, you know. And so I saw through the arc of my three tours in Iraq, especially, that there were definitely going to be limits to what we could do. And then I'll tell you, one of the most frustrating things for me was always, something we say a lot now in retrospect from our wars is that we didn't fight a 20-year war or a 12-year war. We fought one-year wars 20 times. And for me, especially at the highest levels, when I was working at the 3- and 4-star level, is that was demonstrated very clearly that every time a new unit arrived, well, everything that had been green for the last year, everything that had been going well on their stoplight charts and everything that had improved got set back to zero again. And it was incredibly frustrating to watch this short-term mentality that each unit would bring with them that, sure, the 101st did really well here, but, you know, we're the 82nd. We're going to do it better. We're going to do different because they're the 101st and they suck. You know, it's just this very short-term, unfortunate military mindset that we're trained in also can be undermine our success. So while I talked about earlier in this conversation about how the military mindset and discipline can be such an important tool in our toolbox in combat, I also believe the military mindset and focus on victory and decision-making can also undermine us in contexts that aren't directly having to do with getting shot at. We don't do nuance well, you know, and when you're talking about a political solution to a problem, there has to be nuance. So I think, unfortunately, I was painfully aware that we were in a very challenging circumstances as early as 2003, in those early days, saying, this may be beyond our scope. I remember being one of the guys saying, where's our phase 4 plan? I don't understand. You know, we're here at Key West Air Base. I've taken down the government. There's no government. What's the plan now? Where's phase 4? And if you remember the history of it, we didn't get our phase 4 plan for several weeks. Frankly, the insurgency had kind of taken hold by the time we were given orders on how to handle it. I remember talking to a colleague then saying that this is not good. You know, we're not prepared. I mean, I'm getting in an argument with my higher headquarters about how we should handle our local civilians. Hearing an American officer tell me that if we get too dug in here, if we feed them, is what he said to me. It's a true story. If we feed them, it's like these dogs. You know, these dogs run around the base. You know, if we start feeding them, they'll kind of rely on us. We'll never get out of here. And I remember thinking, Jesus Christ, man. You know, we just took out their government. You know, these are human beings. The whole point was to, quote, liberate them. And you're saying, they're dogs. And that's when I really started saying, Jesus, you know, if this is the attitude of people at higher levels than me, we're going to have a problem on our hands. And we did.
That was Fred Wellman. To learn more about Fred and his career after the Army, listen to his interview on Burn the Boats. Thanks for listening to Warriors in Their Own Words. If you have any feedback, please email the team at kharbaugh@evergreenpodcasts.com. We're always looking to improve the show. For updates and more, follow us on Twitter at @team_Harbaugh. And if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to rate and review. Warriors in Their Own Words is a production of Evergreen Podcasts in partnership with the Honor Project. Our producer is Declan Roars. Bridget Coyne is our production director, and Sean Ruhlhoffman is our audio engineer. Special thanks to Evergreen executive producers Joan Andrews, Michael DeAloia, and David Moss. I'm Ken Harbaugh, and this is Warriors in Their Own Words.
It was said that on the ship that traveled to the POW camp, the conditions were so horrible and the hold was so crowded that men would simply die standing up. Letters from My Father is a new docuseries podcast starring Jack Quaid from Oppenheimer and The Boys. It's the story of one woman who retraces her World War II veteran father's steps after he was captured by the Japanese and kept in one of the most notorious POW camps and had to find a way to survive. You can find Letters from My Father from Voyage Media anywhere you listen to podcasts.